Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF, the old standby, WTF. That's right, the podcast that's been around for almost a decade, WTF. Welcome to it. How's it going? You all right? I'm all right, I guess. I'm pretty good. Today on the show, I talked to the Beastie Boys, and I want to talk a little bit about that. A little bit about the Beastie Boys in general, but I'm going to hold off on that, but they are here. But you might want to hang out for the intro. I don't know where it's going to go right now, but I will address some stuff. If you're going to fast forward and just get to it, you're going to enter into a world that I haven't set up for you. You think you know, but you don't know. You know what I'm saying? Isn't that mostly the case? You think you know, but you don't know. Are you big enough a person to say, I don't know? Are you a big enough person to go, I'm wrong? Are you a big enough person to say, like, yeah, I fucked everything up and now I don't have a place to live anymore? That was kind of specific. Before I get to that, let's deal with what's in front of me right now, which is that you can get Too Real, my latest special, in audio format at WTFpod.com. It's right on the front page there. It's nice to have. It's a nice gift. I think you can give it. I don't know. Also, the dates, I've got a couple of dates up there that are happening. The Wheeler Opera House in Aspen, Colorado, March 23rd. Probably going to be snow still, right? The Boulder Theater in Boulder on March 24th. I'm going to be flying one of those little jets, right? Aspen, right into the bucket. Get on that little plane. You're like, woo, we're swooping in and we're swooping out. Two dates. Those two dates at WTFpod.com/tour. They're available. That's happening. You know, I sort of honed in on something that's probably pretty obvious to most of you. And that is the incredible capacity for the human animal to be just immersed in fucking denial. And I get hung up on this shit. But denial in the sense that, like, you know what triggered this? And what it was kind of this moment of catharsis, this kind of moment where my brain just went, oh, shit, of course, that explains it. It's humanity. It's humanity. Is that, you know, in this federal court ruling that deemed Obamacare unconstitutional, the individual mandate, I just started to ask myself, you know, who rejoices this? Who says, finally, we don't have to sign up for health coverage? Finally, that racket is over. Finally, we don't have to chip into the pot so we can all get coverage. I don't understand it on a policy level, but here's the fucked up thing is I started to understand it on a human level. Nobody except grown-up people who have faced adversity or seen it in their life. Nobody wants to think about getting sick. No, they just wait it out. You wait it. It's just something humans do. That's why there's such a strain on emergency rooms, on, you know, the existing healthcare system outside of Obamacare, is that, you know, most people, sadly, I think most people, they're like, yeah, this cough is nothing. Nah, this will go away. This bump will go away. I'm putting some salve on it. No, this is like this. I don't think it's a goiter. I don't think it's a tumor. I don't think it's a glandular problem. I'm just going to put some balm on it. Let's put some arnica on that lump. And of course, you wait it out. You wait it out. It doesn't go the way you go to the emergency room. And it's like all over your body. It's cutting you. It's in your insides. It's something horrible because you waited because you didn't want to accept it. It happens. People do that. Why do you want to confront that shit? But then, like, the thing I put together was, like, this is exactly what we're doing with climate too, it's human nature to rationalize and it's human nature to say, nah, I don't want to think about it. I don't know. We'll deal with it. We'll deal with it. We'll deal with it. And then all of a sudden, the universe has a tumor and it's planet Earth and it's caused by a very sort of self-involved rationalizing species of monsters. Anyway, ceramics. I went to a ceramic sale at a house in Pasadena. There were several people in the backyard, all of them ceramicists selling pots and vases and plates and dishes and art and whatnot. And I bought a little bit from everybody, but I bought this teapot from this woman who I think was Danish. And it was so beautiful and so balanced and so perfectly weighted. And the spout looked great. And she like was clearly attached to it. And I picked it up. I'm like, how much? And she's like, oh, that one. And I'm like, what? She's like, yeah. I'm like, what, do you want to keep it? There's that moment where people, I don't know how people with art who do art of any kind do that. Like you put so much of yourself into something. She's like, that's perfectly balanced. It doesn't leak. It's like, she talked like an engineer about this teapot she made. And it was so perfectly beautiful, hand thrown, just great. And I felt bad for a minute. I felt like I was watching a weird detaching grieving process that lasted about 22 seconds. And then she wrapped it up and I slid my credit card. But it was, I really envied the precision of how she spoke about making teapots. And I thought, see, why can't I do that? Why can't I put something in the world that's tangible and useful? I know this talking sometimes does that, but you can't, you know, you can't serve it at dinner. You can't go, hey, for dessert, if you're wondering what you're eating out of, it's Marc Maron's words. You can't say that. Can you? I can. Yeah. Anyways, the Beastie Boys. So here's the deal, man. I honestly, for me, I was so totally on board. Paul's Boutique, Check Your Head, Ill Communication. I listened to the fuck out of those records. A little bit of Hello Nasty, but then it kind of dropped off. But I definitely listened to three of them, like, a lot. Now, many of you know me. You've known me for years. I'm not a hip-hop guy. I'm not oriented hip-hop-wise. It didn't register with me when I wasn't the age. Or, like, I listen to it now, the bigger names, but I certainly wasn't immersed in it. And, I knew the mainstream stuff. So the Beastie Boys are the Beastie Boys, okay? You know, sadly, Adam Yauch has passed. But, Mike Diamond and Adam Horowitz are still with us, and they wanted to come on the show because they got this Beastie Boys book out. Now, my first reaction when I thought about it is like, how are they not going to be difficult? Not in terms of like, like talking to them, but how are they not going to just be kind of dickish? It's just like, it's the perception you might have of the Beastie Boys. I mean, as great as they are, you listen to their music and you're like, that's just going to be hard to wrangle. Those guys are going to just run around me. They're going to, like, I don't know what it is, but it's not going to be the kind of interview I do. So I was resistant. And then they sent the book, Beastie Boys book, which is, what they're out promoting right now. And I started reading it and I read the whole fucking book because it really gave me insight into their music. There's a lot of pictures. There's a lot of essays by other people. Blake and Jonathan Latham are in here. DJ Anita Sarko wrote a piece in here. There's really a kind of a stunning essay in here that I'm looking for. Oh, Luke Sante, Beastie Revolution, and also the Latham episode was pretty great. But there's also a little chart, sort of interesting little approach to the feminist reaction to the Beasties. And also there's an essay by a woman who was in the band, Kate Schellenbach, who was kicked out of the band in sort of a rude way early on. And she wrote a piece, so they really balanced out. I never even really thought about the kind of feminist reaction to the Beastie Boys in terms of, who they were when they started, the language they used and how that might have offended. But, they seem to get a pass and they seem to have evolved. I think they were just doing it as a, it was a character thing. It was they were doing rap and it was the thing. And now they're grown men and they're fairly sensitive, I thought. And whatever. The point is, there's great pictures. There's all kinds of ephemera about the records, about songs, about food. There's a whole cookbook. There's a Roy Choi cookbook in the middle of the Beastie Boys book. And there's it's I read the whole thing. I don't do that. There's all these essays by Mike and Adam about, you know, being in the Beasties, about, you know, the things that happened with, you know, a lot about Adam Yauch, who was no longer with us. It opens with sort of a eulogy. I love the book, so I'm like, okay, let's do it. Let's have Mike and Adam on. Now, how I approach it, you know, it's usually tricky with two people, but I wanted to learn a little bit about hip hop. I wanted to, you know, connect and talk about the music and talk about New York and, you know, and everything. And, well, my original fears were slightly realized, but not terribly. I mean, the thing, they've been doing this a long time. I get it. But right out of the gate, it was clear that Adam was like, you know, didn't give, I don't know if he gave zero fucks, but maybe gave 1.5 fucks about being here. But Mike D was like engaged and he was in it. And I'm not throwing him under the bus here. I think this might be just the dynamic they do, the good cop, bad cop shit, the sort of run circles around the host kind of business. But ultimately, I got what I got, but I love the book and enjoy. Enjoy me talking to the Beastie Boys. And I love this book. As a guy who lived in New York and missed this time, but there was enough of New York left when I finally did get there to have a certain nostalgia for certain periods in the book. It really is a love letter to New York, to their bandmate and friend that passed, and just to, you know, the sort of great time in a way that these guys had. So this is me, Adam Horovitz, and Mike D talking. So I was at your house.
Yep.
And I met you briefly.
Yep.
And a very nice house.
Super nice house.
It's a very nice house.
It's a rental, but it is.
Is it?
It's, yes.
Oh. Yeah.
And I hate to compliment, I don't know if I should be complimenting Adam or his lovely wife, Kathleen, but they really did. You guys really, the backyard that night of that soiree looked great. You guys really
very nice Mike, out there. Whenever, the rare times that Mike gives me a compliment, it's as though I'm like his 11-year-old son.
Well, it's
like, wow, you really, you did a great job tying your shoes.
Look at look at you.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was a powerful.
Well, and I have the same amount of amazement.
I know.
Too. I could be like when my teen sons actually like do something great. Yeah. I'm like, oh, look at that.
Yeah, it's
I don't
the same
believe
tone.
It. You actually loaded the dishwasher without me telling you. I can't believe it.
It was a powerful night. That was a powerful woman who spoke.
Yeah.
What was her name?
Tina.
They had a very big impact on my girlfriend, who's a painter. She's going to name, her next show is going to be called The Sun Will Not Wait, which Tina brought up in her talking. It was a saying of some kind.
Oh. Well, the charity is called Peace Sisters, and it's two-pronged, and my wife Kathleen's is called Tees for Togo, T-E-E-S, F-O-R-T-O-G-O, Tees for Togo, and it goes to $40 can send a girl in Togo to school for a year.
Yeah.
And there's great T-shirt designs.
Yeah.
Assuming they're still available.
Famous people definitely. By famous people.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And I personally purchased the Ad Rock T-shirt.
Oh, you did?
And then with this plan, I snuck it out of Adam's house and then I wore it on stage. We were doing these shows to promote the book and this kind of stage spectacular, if you will, in the holiday season.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not so spectacular, but we tried.
Where was it? At a bookstore?
No, these
big
are
show?
Theatrical events.
Oh, yeah?
In theaters. It was at in LA, it was here at the esteemed Montalban Theater.
And you guys performed?
Yes, we do sort of, we kind of adapted a version of the book, Beastie Boys book. See, I'm being very professional.
Which is good. Available.
Yeah.
Fine places.
Now. Where you buy books.
And we adapted it basically for the stage, you will.
Really?
Are you
guys playing yourselves?
We've been playing ourselves for a very long time.
Yes. In both senses of the word. But anyway, in the show, at some point, I do a costume change, and I put on my Ad Rock T-shirt and wore it. And Adam did not comment. It didn't faze him at all. He didn't even notice.
He seems very unfazed now. There's sort of a vibe going on, sort of like this has been going on for decades.
It has been.
Yes.
Whatever's
really,
happening.
It's hard to get a rise out
Mike,
of you, Adam.
Mike, see, for me, it's all about the kids. It's all about the children.
Uh-huh.
And
mm-hmm.
it wasn't about the flashy shirt that you wore. It was about the $40. Okay, Mike? So I appreciated it.
Okay. Yeah.
But I was in the workplace, so I didn't have time.
Tunnel vision. I get it. Very focused.
I want to tell you, because I'm very proud of myself, but I actually read this whole fucking book.
Really?
I read the whole...
It's a lot of books.
So you don't have, like, your assistant, or, as we talked earlier, your elves?
No, my one elf?
The elves that don't exist, read it and give you cliff notes?
No, I don't do that. I can't do that. But the thing is, with you guys, is like, it was one of those things. I'm a couple years older than you. I'm not that. I'm 55. I remember listening...
Wow, that's old.
I know, man. What are you, 52? 52?
All right. We're not talking about me right now.
But, like, you know, I knew the records, but I missed the whole thing. Like, I was dug in doing comedy, and there was a lot of things about hip-hop in general and about you guys and about that scene in New York, even though I was there a few years later, that I just didn't know about. So I was like, I better take a look at the book. But then I was like, fuck it, this is great. I loved it. It was, like, not just about you and about the music, but about New York. I mean, about a New York that, like, mm-hmm. you know, is just not there anymore. Right. And it was like, nostalgic, and it kind of got me all warm inside.
We meant to do that.
No, I could feel that.
That's good.
Yeah.
I don't know about the warm inside. I like that, because I don't, maybe you, Adam, were that clearly intentioned.
Well,
but
I mean, we're here in California.
Yeah.
The warm part, we're...
Right. That's true. We are ex-New York. So you did time in New York.
I was from 89. I was there to 89 to 92. And then I went back in like 93 to 2001. I mean, I was there a lot.
Right. That was 1 year.
Yeah.
92 to 93. What happened?
I was in San Francisco.
That's all right.
San Francisco.
No, all right.
You know, I got out.
You had to bounce out for a year.
Yeah, I mean, I was going back and
New
forth.
New York is tough on people. Okay. It's a real, you know, can break
it
people.
It wasn't New York's fault. It was just, the desperation. That's the other thing I like about the story is the, there was definitely ups and downs, even though you were pretty up for a long time. Mm-hmm. But when you, like, growing up there in the 70s, it was fucking crazy. I mean, it was bombed out. It was weird. And you guys were able to just run around and no one, you had parents that, you know, like, kind of half gave a shit.
Yeah. Well, no, I don't know if they half gave a shit. It's kind of like part of the deal. We talked about that a lot. It never even, I don't think, even dawned on us until we were writing this book. Like, what the fuck? Like, our parents just let us run wild in a New York City that's far more dangerous.
It's like 73,
and wild
74?
Than it is now. Yeah, so in the 70s, exactly. So we were exactly kids in the 70s. And so I think that was
part of
the deal.
Well, let's just back it up for a minute.
When
I was seven in 1973.
Let's talk about the age thing. 78?
As a bicentennial, you were a bicentennial child. You know, you were 10.
The bicentennial
Which was a big year for New York City. I remember watching the fireworks, the whole thing. But that was the nice, that was the glossy, nice,
was,
like,
you were young,
sort of Disney-like part of New York. But the reality of New York, and that's what I was trying to get at, is that I think it was the thing of, like, we all had these artsy type parents that all had made this decision of, at that time, if you had two or three, I was the youngest of three boys. So it was like, if you had three kids, you were out of the city.
Yeah.
You moved to Westchester or like Hastings on the Hudson or some bucolic nice place.
Sure, that was
a
idea.
Little bit away, and then you could safely raise your family away from all this chaos. But our families, like, these families decided, like, no, this is for us. We're part of this, like, urban renewal culture, and this is where our lives are going to be. And so that was kind of like the deal was, like, all right, we're buying into this, so our kids are just going to run wild somehow.
Well, actually, you know what? It's different because your mom grew up in New York.
Yeah,
she's from New York. My parents were like the freaks that came to New York to be free, to be artists.
Which is more common, yeah.
In the 60s?
Which is more common, in the 60s. Yeah. So, in the 60s.
Yeah.
Early 60s.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's different.
True.
I guess I hadn't thought about that. Like, my parents came, but your mom was there.
True, but if you ask her, she looks at it like she made it out of the South Bronx. Like, that was her, you know, her aspiration was to make it. She looks at it like she went to New York because that's where all the cool stuff was happening, and she just wanted to get out of the Bronx.
But both of you grew up in very artistic, sort of intellectual households, like open-minded, you know, you were learning things. You had everything the city had to offer sort of came through your parents because they embraced it, and they, you know, there was no real restrictions. They were very encouraging, it seemed like.
I grew up in Greenwich Village. I grew up downtown, and we were just sort of left to our own... You know,
the city was your babysitter.
We just sort of figured it out.
Yeah.
And I knew where my mom was. My mom had a store. And so I knew to be there, you know, when the sun went down.
Yeah.
And that's when she closed the store. So I just had to be there then.
Don't you look back at that as like this tremendous gift? Like, just like it was an amazing childhood.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting how parents are with their kids now as opposed to then.
Do you remember? Yeah, go ahead.
I loved my childhood. I loved running around New York.
It's bizarre to me that because like people always talk about just how fucking dangerous it was. But there even now, there's always people out. There's a safety that I feel in New York that I don't feel here. That you know that I can always walk outside and it's like oh, there's a lot of people here and they'll take care of me somehow.
Right. Well, in 2018, the people walking around late at night in New York just might help you, whereas in 77 they would not.
They were probably on angel dust or other substances.
Do you really think that? I always feel like that if somebody goes down to New York, out of everybody walking by, someone will step in.
No, my favorite is fucked up, but I was crossing the street, this is a long time ago, and an old woman fell in the middle of the street, and a fucking van comes barreling around the corner and screeches right next to her, right next to this old lady on the street, and the guy screams at her, "Fucking Giuliani!" and then just takes off. And we're like, what did that mean? And then we helped the lady up, and I was like, did he mean like Giuliani didn't like fix the streets so they were, she tripped over?
What did he have to do with this poor old woman?
I don't know.
But so that's a bad example. That lady didn't get help.
I think that's the point is that in that this 70s New York that we're talking about from our childhood, it's like you kind of just. There was the stuff that you accepted as normal, which you would never, ever see today. So, like, seeing the term cars on blocks. Like, I remember walking, like, on the blocks between Columbus and Amsterdam, my house on the Upper West Side. Every day you would see, and they'd sit there for weeks and weeks. You'd see you'd see cars where people had taken tires and the rims off of, and they're sitting there on cinder blocks. And that was just what you see. Or you'd see every day. There would not be possible to walk down the street and not see a car whose window had been busted out to grab the whatever's in
there.
They'll
break in for change.
Yeah, right.
But the thing is, a neighborhood is a neighborhood,
right?
And if your kids, you know, roaming neighborhoods, you know, most likely, at least for me, my mom owned a store.
Yeah,
and the store next door, you know,
where was it?
It was in Greenwich Village.
What
on
was
10th
it?
Street? It was a used clothing store for kids. It was called G the Kids Need Clothes. And so I knew everybody in the neighborhood.
By the way, it's a great name.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I knew everybody in the neighborhood. They knew me. They knew my mom.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, like, I'm sure your mom knew the guy at the bike store on Columbus and 80 whatever street. You know what I mean? Like,
It's a weirdly rigged game. Like, I remember, like, that was, like, the big, in terms of this freedom, like, at the beginning, like, back to school. You know, my parents were pretty responsible. My mom's like a responsible parent. So she's like, okay, you're going back to school. You need to go get your back to school clothes. So there was like the store on Broadway where we go, and it was kind of like a rigged game.
Alexander's?
Like they no, it was Morris Brothers. But it was like rigged with Mr. Morris.
Right. He knew.
This is how much my kid can spend.
Right, right.
Yeah, so I felt totally autonomous. Like, I'm walking. Here I am, like, I'm 8 years old. I'm walking to the store to, like, pick out whatever I want for my back to school gear. I think I'm going to get dressed up like Michael Jackson in the cartoon.
No,
this is going to be great. But yeah, well, he kind of, you know, he would steer you a little, like, maybe not so much purple and fringe for you.
Right.
Now, were your parents were they together through your childhood?
No.
So when were they?
No, but separate? I don't think you were allowed to in the early 70s.
No, it was weird. I mean, really, most in that time when we grew up,
yeah.
I mean, my parents were anomalous and they stayed together until my dad died, basically. Mm-hmm. So, which is still young for me, but, and then I was brought up like just a single mom household, but most, I don't know. I just remember, like,
Adam Yauch's parents are the only parents that I could think of from our childhood
that stayed together. Yeah. They stayed together the whole run?
Whole run.
Yeah.
Are they still around?
His mom, Frances, is still alive.
Noel passed away sometime.
A couple of years ago, maybe? 2 years ago?
Way too fast, right?
Isn't it now?
Yeah.
As we get older?
What happens.
I know.
Yeah.
But when you wrote the book, did you, like, how did it make you feel to see your whole life spread out like that? I mean, did you feel old, or were you able to relive it, or did you feel, you got a lot done, and you seemed to have a really good time.
Definitely had a good time. I mean, it's interesting, like, everything that's in that book is pertaining to our band.
Yeah.
So it's not really, like, my specific life. It's my specific life, and same thing with Mike. So then,
yeah.
Meaning it could have been a lot bigger. This book could have been a lot longer.
Well, but the band also—it's
you were in a band for a long time.
The band was our lives, and I think that's one of the points we kind of make in it. And Adam does it really well. Is like we would just hang out with each other all the time.
What was your the primary focus was punk rock, and you had a resistance towards like mainstream rock.
I mean, the primary thing was just getting attention.
Yeah.
Or just, hanging out, like something to do to hang out.
But I don't think it was getting attention. To me, it was like, I wanted to be able to love something that, like most of the kids, I went to this like private high school on the Upper West Side, in junior high school. Then I switched to going to Brooklyn Heights. But yeah. So there are these progressive schools, and most of the kids were kind of like these hippie-ish type kids that would listen to whatever normal
adolescent Dead, stuff. Whatever.
Now you go to like Hendrix.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Black Sabbath, The
sure,
Who,
sure.
whatever. So I was desperately like, what do I find that I'm gonna love that none of them are gonna.
How am I gonna be
listen
different?
To?
How am I gonna be different?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, when we were kids, pop music was pretty amazing. What they played on the radio,
true.
Just the variety of things. Like you'd have David Bowie fame.
Right.
You know, Carole King. There's so many different styles of music played on just top 10.
Leo Sayer,
yeah.
Big name.
Right.
Big
no,
name
but it is true.
What was
like pop
big hit?
Music, you'd hear everything from, Leo Sayer was Leo
It's got the word.
She make me feel like dancing.
Ooh. Oh, that one, yeah.
You should sing
wasn't
more
there
of that.
You should just keep singing.
It's really
that.
Embarrassing.
There's
that
a
I
slow
instead
one.
Of just saying the name, but you
like,
can't just say the name to the Leo
no,
Sayer
feel
song.
Like
you got to do the
night away.
Yeah, you got to do the high voice.
Make me feel like dancing, woo. Dancing.
He
definitely had a slow one.
Yeah, I can't remember
he
what
must
it was.
Have
you
a
make
slow
my
jam.
Heart.
I mean, that high
do
voice.
Something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That high voice would be a waste if it didn't have a slow jam.
I remember those songs that, like, even like Harry Nilsson songs. Like
oh, yeah, Harry Me and My Arrow. But that's the point. AM radio, like, I remember, like, vividly as a kid, like, I'd wake up to, like, I had the clock radio by my bed. Because I was, like, the youngest of three kids. So my mom, at point, like, for me, I had to get my own shit together to get to school on time.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, my mom was over it by then. So I had the clock radio. And AM radio, you'd hear, like what Adam was saying, like Paul Simon would come on, like 50 Ways to Your Lover, then some disco song, like Boogie Oogie Woogie.
So that was the backdrop.
Disco song would come, and then Wild Cherry,
play that funky music.
It was weirdly wide, even though it was all pop music, but it was weirdly wide open, I think, in a way.
So when punk...
And so when you're young, and then when you get to be, you know, when you start to form your own sort of identity... That's when you gravitate towards the thing that's you. And I feel like pop music in 1979.
Yeah.
I don't know what it was.
It was kind of disco, wasn't it?
Disco was
cocaine
definitely part
had
of the
really
element.
Taken its effect on popular music.
Right.
Just shit was just weird. And punk rock just. And Mike and I were lucky that we had older siblings. And so they kind of introduced us to some things that
we
really gravitated towards.
Like
what? The Clash.
Oh, yeah.
The Clash, for sure. Or, like, I had the older brothers that, like, brought home Devo record. I was like, what is this? This is the weirdest fucking thing I have ever seen. I still, to this day, like, what do you compare Devo to?
Nothing.
Like,
they're singular. So there's that moment where you realize there's something else going on out there that is not in the periphery.
Yeah, yeah. This is what I want to be.
Yeah.
This is who I am.
What's
so
your older siblings turn you on to?
No, I think The Clash, you know,
was it?
When we were little kids, me and my brother and sister would listen to, same thing with Mike, Jackson 5 and all of that great stuff when we were kids.
Yeah.
And then as you get older, you want to, you know, choose the thing that you're going to be.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That you are interested in.
Yeah.
And for us, it just sort of happened that punk rock, you know, in 77 blew up enough to come over to America, and then bands in America and the Ramones, and it just sort of was all happening that we got in touch with that at a young age.
The whole New York punk scene, up when you were like 15, 16?
Well, no, we are too young.
Too young for
I'm noticing
I'm sorry.
Of some advanced
I'm 3 years
techniques.
Older. I apologize.
No, but yeah, we were too young for that initial like CBGB's,
for the New York Dolls and
Ramones.
Shit.
Yeah. Definitely New York Dolls, but even the Ramones, Patti Smith, Talking Heads,
right.
That era, we were still, whatever, 10 years old.
Yeah.
So we were, even in all our freedom, we weren't going to CBGB's as 10-year-olds. Like
at 13 and 14.
Yeah, 14 we were.
Yeah. They would let you in at 10, right?
Yeah, no, they probably would have. Like,
you
I mean, nobody.
Depending on who you were with, yeah.
I mean, but certainly as 13 and 14-year-olds, we went everywhere, and that included bars, whatever, because it was that was another aspect to New York then.
You could do that, yeah.
You could do that, and the drinking age was 18, so it's kind of like, yeah, basically they were like, the myth was always if you could reach the bar, you could get a drink.
So where did you all meet?
Well, I met Adam Yauch,
yeah,
MCA, at Bad Brains show. So Bad Brains were like this weirdly incredible hardcore band from Washington, D.C., but then moved to New York, and they were faster. And kind of for us, like, that was next level exciting to the punk rock. And I just happened to go to this teeny bar. I saw an ad for them playing. This is Boys and Girls, way before there were things called smartphones.
Uh-huh.
Adam likes me to show the phone.
I actually hate it. Mike normally would take the phone out of his pocket.
And illustrate, and I'm like illustrating a point, Adam. That's what I'm doing. But anyway, so
you met him
I saw an ad and went with like my one other punk rock friend from high school who was named John Barry, who was the first guitar player in Beastie Boys. We go to the show, and there's like 12 people there, and there's only one other like young teenager, one other teenager, period, and it was Yauch.
Yeah.
And so I was scared, way too scared to start talking to him, but John, our guitar player, he was more socially skilled.
Oh, it wasn't because Yauch had an aura or a presence?
No, well, Yauch was cool because he was wearing this like trench coat and had a couple of homemade buttons on it. And he was more advanced and more skilled in punk rock looking than I was. I was still looked like this like schlubby Jewish kid
stuff,
from the Upper West Side. I didn't have it all down yet.
Certainly not the chiseled, hunkish look you have now.
And where did you guys meet you?
Oh, man, it was Milan, 72. Yeah, must have been.
On a film set.
Yeah, we were listening to some Italo disco. It was like 5 a.m. Sun was coming up.
You know, that slow, sleazy disco. I think I met Adam and Mike for the first time at the Black Flag at Peppermint Lounge. I think. I'm not 100% sure.
I kind of remember Rat Cage. This is this record store we'd all hang out at, but the basement one on Avenue A.
That was like, the Rat Cage was sort of your second older sibling thing in terms of turning you on to stuff, right?
Yeah, there was this record store that we would all sort of cut school and go and hang out at.
Yeah.
And
some of us would go after school, Adam, like having completed a school day.
No,
I
didn't mean to implicate you. Anyway, it was like our hangout. It was really cool to have like a hangout, like
it's
a punk,
the best.
Punk
hangout.
No, it's the best. And it's also that thing like I think we try to get across in the book is like that at that time in New York, that's how you to find out what was going on, you had to go to point A to run into this friend or that friend or just even somebody you don't know that's like, oh yeah, you guys should go to this thing tonight.
Sure,
otherwise you have no freaking idea like what
because it wasn't mainstream and you didn't even know if the bands were playing and you had to sort of be in the loop to figure out what was going on or even get the records at that point,
right? I just got sidetracked thinking about our circle of friends in 1982 and how we all sort of gravitated because Manhattan's an island, right?
Yeah.
And so, but there's some of us were in Brooklyn Heights, a little deeper into Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And then Mike's uptown. Mike and John were way uptown and we're in the Village. But like, so you and John came down because you met Yauch and Yauch and Arabella, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then Yauch went to school with
he was still going to school way out in Brooklyn. Way out, but pretty far.
It's pretty far.
Pretty deep, like Murrow. And then, he was the one punk rock kid at Murrow.
Which is must have been tough.
It was hell.
That was
hell for him to be like in deep Brooklyn and just have all these like
buttons,
these like ID Guido dudes yell at you every day because you're like the weird freak looking kid.
Yeah, there's never a shortage of commentary in New York on the street about how you look or what you are.
Oh yeah, definitely. And much more then, I feel. I feel like now people are probably reasonably polite. Like then, it was like that was normal. If like I was gonna walk by like the Hayden Planetarium, which is where the subway is, and I was like a Friday or Saturday night, and that's when Laser Rock was going on. It was like all these guys getting wasted to go see Laser Zeppelin or whatever. Yeah. It was normal that they would yell shit at me and basically want to kill me.
When you guys started, did you take lessons? Did you play? Did you just learn to play your instruments just by getting them?
I had a really sweet, I called her the last living bohemian in Greenwich Village. I had this very lovely and out there godmother.
Yeah.
It was almost like a fairy godmother. She convinced, I don't know how she did, she convinced my mom to get me a drum set.
Oh, so
and my mom
drums.
Said yes. Like, I can't believe.
No, it's really cool having a child with a drum kit in an apartment.
Yeah, like, I'm in an apartment on the Upper West Side with a drum set.
Yeah.
And I was able to play it like whatever after school. It was pretty crazy.
And how'd you start playing guitar?
my mom and her friends bought me a guitar for my 12th birthday. They decided that I was going to be a guitar player.
Uh-huh.
And somehow, I guess my mom hooked it up. She knew someone who knew a guitar teacher who happened to be Laurie Anderson's sister.
Yeah.
So I took a
couple
guitars.
That's New York, right?
Yeah. I didn't know.
Mike, I told you that like maybe once.
You know,
I'm a huge
Laurie Anderson fan.
But
I'm just saying, like when I saw United States.
No, I know, but this is Laurie. I'm talking about Laurie Anderson's sister.
Yeah.
guitar teacher.
Yes.
She taught me how to play, my first song I ever learned on guitar was Mystery Dance by Elvis.
Oh, that's
really?
Great.
Yeah.
That's a fucking hip guitar player.
It's a great song.
So I asked her to teach me that song. She's like, what song do you want to learn?
Right. So you learned the essential rock and roll thing, the thing.
The mystery dance.
Yeah. I want to tell you about the mystery dance.
Great song.
Yeah, yeah.
So I only took a couple lessons with her, and then Adam Yauch gave me a couple guitar lessons. He was like, this is how you do this and that.
So he was a good guitar player.
I don't think he ever had lessons.
Uh-huh. Right? Well, that's the sort of like the feeling about Yauch's absence in this book is that he was this almost mystical, all-knowing kind of dude who understood things innately and was there always for you guys to sort of show you and keep you pushing you ahead into things. He seemed mm-hmm. to know things that no one else knew in a way.
Well, I knew things at a time when still to this day, we're mystified. Like, how did he know this? Because it's you don't have YouTube. You don't there wasn't like he, in his bedroom, there was this stack of textbooks of like rewire a guitar amp.
He just knew. He was the kind of guy who would take things apart and put them back together.
He literally would take stuff apart and put it back together for fun, and
right.
like stuff that you would see in his room. Like he'd literally have.
Well, that's how he figured
like,
it out.
What's
probably.
Going on there? He's like, oh, I wanted to see. I just was curious. I took it apart and I'm just putting it back together.
So the punk rock thing, what lasted a couple years for you guys? Like seriously, when you were playing punk before hip hop came in,
for our entire lives. Really.
Well, yeah, no, I know the spirit of it, but actually being a punk band.
Well, being a punk, I think you get tired of it after a bit.
Sure,
it's the hardcore is great in terms of like the access point.
Yeah.
Like, okay, wait. You just, here's the A part, here's the B part. You know a few chords.
Yeah,
write a few stupid words. It's like you get it together, so it has a great, and also you're able to then book gigs and make your own flyers. It's all, you can do it all yourself, and also all your friends are doing something that's related to, so everybody's doing stuff and it's really exciting. But
making your own clothes,
that too, but musically it kind of runs its core. It's just limiting after a little bit
for us.
Yeah,
right.
For us, that's just how we felt about it, and that's not punk rock general, that's
right.
specific hardcore punk
yeah
rock.
American hardcore, yeah.
And we, you know, after a while, yeah, we got sort of tired of it. We wanted to do different things, and we did try to play. We can't sing.
Right.
I think that's a major thing that held us back. That if any one of us could have.
They're still holding you back, Adam, with that not singing stuff.
It sucks.
Yeah.
It sucks. We could have been contenders. We could have done something.
You did something.
But I'm just saying, we actually wrote and recorded some songs where, like, Mike was singing, and it was like, we suck.
Yeah.
And that's not a slight. I'm worse than Mike. Yauch's worse to me, and Yauch's worse to, like, we're all terrible.
Right.
And so, and at the same time, as kids, when rap was getting played on the right when rap was sort of starting to get to come out of the Bronx and downtown, we loved listening to rap records. And that was something that we could kind of do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
True.
And that was more inspiring.
Yeah, but
I would also say rap was more inspiring, but it also seemed more, at least to me, it seemed more radical at the time. Like, it just was more, there was no precedent to it in my world. Like, there was nothing, there's nothing that prepared me to hear something, especially when rap changed, like when records like Run DMC, Sucker MCs came out and things were kind of reduced down and more minimal and just a drum machine and rapping.
Yeah.
That was so just completely different and radical to anything.
Right. It felt more punk than like
than punk.
Cro-Mags or whatever, not to say I'm definitely not saying anything negative against the Cro-Mags.
This is a controversial podcast.
Please.
First we went in on Migos, now Cro-Mags.
I'm not saying anything against the Cro-Mags.
Send an armored vehicle for us, please, after this.
Right. It's,
I just don't want to get beat up. Please.
Well, I think also, like, you know, when you talk to people like Watt, who we talked about earlier, the idea of punk initially, that it wasn't a sound. It was just the ability to do whatever the fuck you wanted and make your own thing.
Right. I retract that. It sounded more punk than, say, rap music in 1983 sounded more punk than the Minutemen.
Right. I get it.
Right.
So, but it spoke to you in a way where you saw possibilities. You were like, this is like, it moved you and you were like, holy shit,
and
what
we
is
and we just loved it. Yeah. It was like this thing where I just loved it. I mean, and not unlike when Adam was talking earlier, like being younger kids in a household, when we heard The Clash, it was like, okay, that's for me. But then hip hop was like exponential with that. Like as soon as we heard rap records and rap music, it was like, wait, we can do that. And then like what Adam said, when those hip hop artists started coming downtown from the Bronx, from Harlem, whatever, and you saw everything kind of just unfolded in front of you again, which is another thing about growing up in New York. You can go to this club, Negril, where all of a sudden the very first downtown hip hop nights had happened, or then that moved to Roxy because it got too big, and you go to Roxy and it was like packed with like B-boys and B-girls from all over, and like dudes were doing cocaine in the bathrooms, and it was like this whole crazy, and people were getting robbed
again,
in the bathrooms.
I was not doing cocaine in the bathroom.
I'm not implicating you.
Okay.
But you're also tapped
No, but that's the point. We were kids that we didn't actually even know what was going on. I was just like, whoa, this is what's going on. We had
this
no
idea.
This
was also before hip-hop. This is like when rap was just, when because of these places, breakdancers were there, graffiti writers were there, rappers were there, DJs were there, and they were like just sort of formed into this thing.
Oh, quick side note. I want to go back. This goes back to Laurie
Anderson.
I have another
side note. I want to borrow that book over there.
Which one?
The Wrecking Crew. I'll return it.
Okay. You can. Okay.
You've seen the documentary.
I haven't.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to read the
book. You should see the...
I know. I haven't seen Titanic either.
So, but...
I like that you put them in the same category. Oh, wait, my footnote, though, was back to Laurie Anderson's sister is a guitar teacher.
Teacher, yeah.
This is another footnote of us growing up in New York at the time we did. It was somehow like we were exposed to all these, this like freak show that our various parents had in their homes. We were never like kept out of it. It was always integrated into
it. Like, what
it.
Do you mean?
So,
like, which part of the freak show?
It was just
artists
whatever. It was all artists, music, like all these like super strongly opinioned.
Yeah.
These are people who had chosen to be in New York for a reason, and that's because they were going to have their say and in what they made and in what they said every single day of their lives, and that just seemed normal to us.
Right. But you guys were tapped into the whole sort of like dance thing too, right? The club thing outside of the rap. Because I remember Danceteria. I remember going there once, but you guys had a real experience with that place.
We lived there. Because it was just so exciting to go to the club where there's all this different music happening. It was all mixed together and you loved it all. And then also, whatever, we're teenagers. Like all of a sudden you realize like there's girls dancing.
Yeah.
You might be able to actually... Well, we couldn't really dance with girls because that was like that just wouldn't really go down like that. Then that would be way too normal.
Right.
But you could actually just talk to girls was pretty exciting.
And so what was the first? Because I know you made you made a punk record, right? That you guys sort of pressed yourself, or that or Dave Parsons helped you out with
from the Rat Cage.
Yeah. And then what was the Cookie Puss song the first sort of rap song ish?
Yeah, we actually went and recorded some songs, kind of more punk.
Right. Well, like Adam said, we were kind of trying to sing a little bit, which was terrible, terrible idea. And everything we made kind of sucked. We went into the studio, it was this friend of Yauk's parents that gave us, like hooked us up with studio time. But the one thing we made that we liked, or two things, was Cookie Puss and this other song, Beastie Revolution, where both we were just like screwing around, kind of making fun of music that we actually loved, which is a weird New York kid thing to do, maybe.
Right.
And but yeah, Cookie Puss comes out and it's like kind of like, I don't know, I guess us trying to do, we loved like world famous Supreme Team Buffalo Gals.
Yeah.
So we wanted to make our thing, and all of a sudden at like this club, Danceteria, they started playing that. So that was like the most thrilling
thing
ever as a
your
teenager.
Song.
They started playing Cookie Puss, exactly mixed in with these other records. So like to have that as a teenager, then you're kind of like, whoa, things are really happening for us now.
It was kind of.
And then we were on the Joe Franklin show.
Joe Franklin.
Yeah, that made me spill more water on myself. That was She's On. That was a little bit later.
No, I know,
though.
But I was just timing that one.
You got me on that one. You got me on that one, Joe.
I like that Crazy Eddie plays an important part in the story somewhat.
Right?
Yeah. Because when you grow up on the East Coast, because when I go visit my grandmother and shit, I mean, they had those stations. Crazy Eddie was everywhere. And then there was like those two stations that only ran like the Bowery Boys and Laurel and Hardy movies. Like, I can't remember, like Channel 11 or something.
That was so good. Yeah, yeah. No, right? And Little Rascals.
Right, Little Rascals, exactly.
But
all day long.
They're not showing that anymore.
No, man.
They're not showing Little Rascals and Bowery Boys.
Wait till you see that new movie with the Laurel and Hardy movie.
I know, tomorrow.
Oh, I'm supposed to go. Yeah, are you? But you're not going to be here.
I can't go tomorrow.
Oh, it's so good,
it's
you
tomorrow.
Guys.
Tomorrow.
It's so good.
Tomorrow's right. I didn't see. RSVP. Did you?
I did because I can't go.
It's so good.
I know.
Okay, all right.
Seen
I'm
it already?
Yeah, I saw a screener because I interviewed Coogan. Mm-hmm. It was great. It's really touching.
Well, it really I don't know, though, but John Reilly, he's in Laurel and Hardy, but he's also in Holmes and Watson.
Yeah, Holmes and Watson.
Cool.
Two historical couplings.
No, he's great as Hardy. It's like it's
he's
astounding.
Kind of one of my heroes.
It's really a stunning movie.
Yeah, but so let's shout out to John C. Reilly for that.
Right. Let's try to do some history here.
Okay.
So what?
I thought that's all we've been doing.
It is kind of, okay. But isn't that what you've been doing?
Yeah, I know. We're stuck in the past.
Are you tired? Are you tired of it?
You tired?
No.
You know, you should get a dog.
I feel all right. I got cats. Okay. I got three cats. I don't need a dog.
Okay. Three. You went with a third one?
I have a third
after
cat.
After the two?
Yeah, I had two, and then I found one. He found me, showed up, and okay. I took him in. I had no choice.
How did the other cats feel about that?
It was rough because they're old, and this guy's driving them nuts. They were in their retirement, enjoying their later years. Now they got this fucking lunatic bothering
Where's the pan? Where do you keep the pan? In the house? Outside
what, the kitty box?
Yeah, the cat
There's
box.
Three of them. Now I got two. I got.
Do they each have their own kitty box.
Well, you got to. It's a lot of shit, man. It's all, you know, cats. They run the house. I went through a thing this morning. I can't deal with it. I got the house clean, and they get the litter all over everything. There's nothing I can
not
fucking
cool.
do about it. No. There's a lot of things that
you
aren't
need,
cool
yeah.
about cats. But
yeah.
you have them.
Had.
Uh huh. What happened? You let it outside.
I can't. I
you can't go into
I
it.
Can't go back there.
I don't know.
That's where you can't.
Psychologically.
Let's just say they're dead.
Okay. Yeah, well, you got to keep them inside out here.
Yeah.
All right.
True.
So,
all right, anyway, sorry. Back to history. Yeah. We went to feline history, but...
But so after Cookie Puss, then like you started like what's sort of fascinating to me, even though there seems to be no shortage of resentment and bad blood there, is that I really had no idea that you guys sort of, in a sense, found Rick Rubin, or you were brought into him, and that he was sort of integral in helping you define who you were at the time. How did that happen?
Well, I mean, that was, that goes back to Cookie Puss. We
right.
made Cookie Puss, and we had this idea like, okay, we couldn't replicate that song live because it's
right.
a crank phone call and whatever.
Yeah.
So, but there are all these rap songs we've memorized every word to. So we'll just start doing that. We needed a DJ. So this friend of ours, like, here, I'll take you over to this dorm room. This guy
yeah,
I know,
right.
he's got all the equipment.
Yeah.
And supposedly he had a bubble machine, although we never saw it with our naked eyes.
A bubble machine.
The bubble machine. But
right.
he did in his dorm room, his little teeny NYU,
at NYU
dorm
yeah.
room. He had a full PA with all DJ equipment. And it was like that. I guess he was the first person we knew with a drum machine, too. So it was like, he was the kid that had all the equipment. So it was like, you're hired.
Right.
You got all the shit, you're hired.
He was just some weird kid at a dorm, sort of a stoner kid who had all this shit.
Definitely not a stoner kid, but he was very strange. He's just a couple years older, but I don't know. He just was very intense and very ambitious.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't put it like that when you're a kid because you don't understand what that means, but he was just making it happen.
Right.
Yeah.
And he had all the equipment,
well,
so you hired
parents,
him.
Like, were somehow, yeah, his parents were like, you're... Little Ricky, you want drum machine? Here's the budget. You're right, and you want a PA? Fine. And somehow also in the dorm, like it was great. Like this PA was fucking loud, and it was in his dorm room. Like wouldn't you get? Like I feel like now wouldn't you get kicked out of a dorm for having that? But
you'd
anyway,
get in some kind of trouble maybe.
Yeah,
but he was a rap fan and a hard rock fan.
Yeah, well, he came from like he unlike us, like he came from what? Well, so he came from like this Long Island heavy metal thing
yeah.
that we rebelled against
right.
and then but then he got into hardcore and then he got into rap, so we kind of had that shared, and then he started playing like AC/DC and stuff and Zeppelin and all the stuff, so we're like, oh, actually, you know,
not
this
bad.
Is actually kind of cool.
Well, the interesting thing at that time was that, at least for me personally, I never really thought about production.
Yeah.
The first record I ever made was with my band, The Young and the Useless. And it's great. I love it.
A hardcore band.
Yeah, hardcore band. But, it's so bad that at one song, the drummer just stops. And there's like, we just keep playing. And then he starts kind of back playing again. And then at some point, we finish the song. It's like, we weren't thinking about production,
right.
certainly.
Yeah. Wasn't that part of it?
As well as like skill level or any of that stuff.
Yeah.
And then Rick was a producer. Like, I don't know, he just decided at a young age, I'm a record producer, which was inspiring.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Rick had this thing with me. He's like, no, Mikey, like, you're going to sound like you're working hard. Like, right. don't try to make it sound like you're smooth, because you're not.
Yeah.
Like, he had that identity and that sense of being a producer that, like what Adam said, that was beyond our
right
grasp. And then it was funny, after he went to see the show that we did here in LA, and he said something kind of interesting. We were
recently
texting. Yeah, we were texting back and forth.
You guys are okay now?
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, there's a lot of fucked up shit that happened, but we were all really young and all handled stuff really, really badly when you get down to it. And I think we can all look at it, but I think we're able to be okay because we all came out of it all right.
Okay.
You know, it's not like we're starving. It would be a different story if we were like never got paid for our license ill and we're just, you know, working at the car wash.
Right.
I don't think we'd...
And that's still... Like,
I don't
that,
think we'd
that's
be quite
the,
so forgiving.
The cliffhangers in the book that kind of, like, I was... It made me angry. Did you ever get restitution?
No, but I think we got free... It was more than that. We got freedom. We were allowed to be who we wanted to be. And okay. Anyway, that's the text that he said. He was like, you know what? And he's like, this weird way... Uh-huh. Everybody got what they wanted. That doesn't mean that's not at the expense of somebody else, right? But he's like, look, I got to produce lots of different artists, which is what I always wanted. You guys got to, I mean, this is his words, I wouldn't call this up, but he's like, you got to go on and become an iconic group and do exactly what you wanted. And he's like, and Russell got a check. And right. That's all Russell wanted.
Right.
So.
All right. Well, you seem to be handling it better.
Well,
than
no, Mike. Him. Mike. See, Mike. Mike is a jerk, right? And everybody knows it. But he is much
most
more
people. I don't know everyone. There are a couple of people I've fooled.
But he is much more forgiving than I am.
Right.
Ultimately, I'm fine.
Yeah.
I'm happy. We're happy.
Yeah.
We're all doing things in the world.
Right.
We're healthy.
Yeah. Okay.
No
got
problem.
It.
No mm-hmm. problems.
I got it. But so can we just talk for a minute? Run DMC changed your life.
Yeah.
In terms of like, you know.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah. Like when did you first meet them and how did that happen?
We met them through Rick Rubin and made a record called It's Yours. He meets Russell Simmons, who had heard It's Yours, and Russell's DJ Run from Run DMC's brother and also the manager of Run DMC meets Rick at Danceteria, where we go all the time, and like, can't believe, okay, wait, you made It's Yours? You're this like white guy with long hair, like, this is really weird.
Yeah,
somebody outside of my, you know, and rap at that time was such a small universe. It was like there's only one, there was like two producers, whatever.
Yeah.
So then they started talking and they were like, okay, we're gonna work together. And then Rick told Russell about us, about Beastie Boys, like, here, I got these white guys,
but yeah,
they love the rap anyway. So then Russell introduced us. I mean, obviously we are already huge, huge Run DMC fans.
Right.
I mean, Sucker MCs, that was
83, 84. Yeah.
So that was before your New York arc, but it was like, that was one of those records, like the same way After It, Public Enemy, Bring the Noise, or like there's certain songs that like Summertime in New York that would just take over. You hear out of every car driving by, every boombox, every open window, you would hear that song.
It's like when Sorry dropped, Justin Bieber's Sorry.
Yeah.
It was like that moment.
I'd like to say Despacio more.
Like you heard it everywhere.
That's next level, but that's international.
You heard it everywhere. It was just everywhere.
Not really everywhere, but kind of everywhere.
Yeah, well, within New York, it was within the island of Manhattan.
Yeah.
It's everywhere, and it's really dense. You're like, you can walk down one block, and then 30 seconds later on the next block, you're hearing another part of the same song from a different radio station or different whatever. So it was just completely revolutionary. We loved it. And so then when all of a sudden we meet Run DMC, it was really meeting our heroes.
Right.
It really was like, whoa, these guys are doing it. They know what they're doing.
Yeah. And then you open for them and now you're on the same label as them. That all happened.
Well, not same label, same management.
Yeah.
Russell Simmons is Run from Run DMC's brother.
Yeah.
And so Russell managed Run DMC and then he managed us.
Yeah.
And so we ended up opening for Run DMC on a tour with us, Timex Social Club, LL Cool J, and the group Houdini and Run DMC. And we all spent a magical summer together.
Yeah. That was your first tour?
That was not our first tour, but it was our first time playing shows with them.
Yeah.
But
we were on an esteemed artist before that, Madonna.
Oh, the Madonna tour that, yeah, you wrote about that.
That was a year before that.
Yeah.
But anyway, just being on tour with Run-DMC, it was kind of amazing. It was like three of us. They were a little bit older, and they were definitely way cooler than us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And way better than us, like as a rap group. And so it was just like education every night, and just the way they commanded the stage, how they worked their set list, how they, like, we learned so much from them.
Yeah.
And as, you know, as just people hanging out in the summertime, like, we just can't thank them enough.
Yeah. No, I mean, it literally was the blueprint. Like, they gave us the blueprint of, okay, this is how you do it. And especially, I mean, Jam Master Jay, RIP, Jay had this way of, like, he really saw how they're going to present themselves.
Yeah.
How the show was going to look. None of that stuff was even on the table to us. None of it had occurred to
us. To be a showman, how to put on a show and how to arrange your stuff.
Well, so the year before that, the summer before that, we had opened for Madonna on tour.
Yeah.
And so that was like next level show. That was like real showbiz.
Yeah.
That was like showbiz, which was awesome. But like it would be crazy to think that we could do that.
How were you received on that tour?
Oh, they fucking hated us.
Yeah.
It was awesome.
Literally booed off the stage night after night.
Well, we didn't, booed as we were leaving.
Well, we didn't get off the stage because we would stay on the stage despite the booing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was just a 10-minute maybe 8-minute boo fest. It was pretty great.
It was all little girls too, so it was like high pitched boos.
Well, it was young, you know, like 8 to 11-year-old girls and their parents.
Well, their parents. And remember, their parents, they're young. They can't go to the show themselves, but the parents bring them, and it's like, it's like you said, it's all young girls
guys
with the Madonna bracelets and
the
mesh everything.
Yeah,
and you're just Madonna up there being makeup.
The raw Beastie Boys. And
yeah,
like,
we were basically
the fuck
making them cry.
And they didn't think that was funny or ironic or like cool in a New York City kind of way at all.
So that,
they just
but
wanted
you
those
saw
assholes to get off stage,
right? But you saw real show business
from Madonna.
But there was nothing we could really take away from it because we're not capable of that.
Like, right?
We're not
studio
we
musicians.
We can't sing, dance, and you know, look
but
beautiful.
But still, just to like be on a real stage, like we had been on stage at CBGB's,
right?
You know, like just punk clubs or whatever.
Yeah,
and now we're at Radio City Music Hall. Which was definitely a big lesson because it's a huge stage and we got winded really quick.
Yeah, yeah. We did not pace ourselves well.
But no, I barely ever saw a show like that, let alone be on the side of the stage watching it all the time. So we learned just a lot from Madonna. But from Run-DMC was like something more that we could do.
Right. A template.
Yeah.
Yeah, and plus also just socially, we got...
Oh yeah, Madonna didn't hang out with us.
Yeah, it's not like you're to hang out with Madonna.
Right. Oh no.
I mean, we wanted to, but she, you know,
you guys aren't pals now.
She was smarter than that. She had stuff to do. But
you
know, Run-DMC were like they took us in. We'd hang out every day.
She wasn't looking to drink 40s with us,
right?
And like watch basketball games.
Yeah.
Does that beautiful?
Not to say that she doesn't drink 40s and watch basketball games.
No,
she
might.
She does.
Yeah. But there's that nice story you tell about Run-DMC coming up with that first line. For the first record, you know, that you know, he comes running around the corner. I don't remember which one.
Oh, yeah, for our song, Paul Revere.
Yeah.
So that's a story in the book, which is available in the marketplace.
I'll sell the book for you.
As told by Snoop Doggy Dogg on the audiobook. Mike, I'm working hard right now.
Really? Just
you
checking all the boxes.
Audiobook?
Are you serious?
Yeah,
dude, we have an audiobook for our book.
Star-studded. John C. Reilly. Incredible reading.
John C. Reilly, guest reader. Snoop Dogg, guest reader. Rachel Maddow. Bette Midler. Tim Meadows.
Maya Rudolph. Goes on and on.
Talib Kweli. Chuck D. LL Cool J.
Jarvis Cocker.
I'm just repeating words, names that Mike says.
Our
audiobook is, I mean, it crushes the competition at Christmas time, Mike.
It really does. In terms of quality,
it kicks ass.
How does
Mike?
It make you feel?
Oh, Bobby Cannavale, great.
Bobby Cannavale.
Yeah, that these people like they have this respect.
Steve Buscemi.
They love you. All these people, you had such a profound influence on everybody. You have such amazing, eclectic fans. How does that make you feel? Great.
It's confusing. I would just assume that they had absolutely nothing else to do that day.
No,
just decided
no,
it was...
yeah, the, it's so that's
Adam,
the one
these
thing
are
about
busy
the...
you know, accolade filled people.
No, it's weird. It's weird. If Steve Buscemi called you and was like, I want you to be in my movie for a day, you'd be like, of course.
Yeah.
But we did a video years ago that Yauch directed. It was the last video. Well, it wasn't the last video. It was one of our second to last video, and this long video, and a lot of people are in it, and Steve Buscemi's in it.
Yeah.
And it is Buscemi, not Buscemi.
Uh-huh.
I always said Buscemi, but it's
Buscemi. Yeah, I always made the same mistake.
And I'd asked him. He was there. He was in our video, and I was like, why are you here?
Yeah.
And he was like, of course I'm here. Yeah. Yauch wrote to me and asked me to be in it, and of course.
The New Yorkers.
And it doesn't make sense. Like, yeah. I don't get it. It's awesome, but
you had a profound effect on so many lives. I'm working on a show right now with Alison Brie, and she said she went to see you on the Hello Nasty tour at the Forum, and she was a teenager, and she fainted. She fainted. Alison Brie fainted at your show.
So she's blaming us for her.
No, I mean,
is there some kind of responsibility here?
No, it's like Beatlemania. You know, you had an effect.
I mean,
yeah.
Put on a good show.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to say it. I mean, you can go see other bands.
Right.
Yeah. But, I mean, Belle Biv DeVoe, they would have that effect on people sometimes.
Right.
Okay.
But you know what I'm saying.
So let's we're going to be here all day.
Yeah.
So you make the first, let's get to the
can
first
order
record.
Can we lunch? If we are
sure,
here
we
all
could.
Day.
Yeah, I can.
Oh my God,
I
had soup dumplings last night.
Where at?
At a new place.
Yeah. Where?
Yeah,
where?
You won't name
in
where?
Pasadena Lake. It's called Dan Modern or some weird name.
Great.
It's the dude from Luscious Dumpling, I think, got his own spot on Lake Avenue.
I also like you have a cookbook in your book.
Roy Choi.
Yeah, Roy
LA
Choi.
LA's own.
Yeah.
Roy Choi, who I imagine.
Out of nowhere, here's a little reprieve. Here's some recipes.
They're,
enjoy.
And they're good.
Yeah, they look good.
Well, you know, and we've mentioned food a lot in our songs. We also spent a lot of our time recording together, thinking about and ordering food.
Yeah.
That's the thing that I don't know if people know about bands. That the thing they do more than anything else, more than concerts or recording or whatever, is eating together or ordering food or talking about where to order food. That's that's the number one thing in a band.
That's it? So after the first record, I liked how there's a couple things in the book that you do where you both comment on each other's essays in the side notes, which I think is funny. That was good. But also the way that, you know, because I even talking to my girlfriend, and, you know, who I said loves your wife, who was a bikini kill, that how you kind of had to reconcile with this sort of thing you unleashed with License to Ill, that, you know, that you were doing this music, you were sort of elevated characters, you had a way of doing it, that, you know, and one day you're looking out at, you know 20,000 bros who are not of necessarily your ilk. And then how you look back on that and kind of, I think you're contrite about it, but you're also sort of, you own it. But, you know, that was something you had to think about. Like, what? How does this look now? Who were we then? And what does it mean to women? And you know, because you actually have a feminist defense or two of your work in the book. There are other essays by other people in the book. Now, when you first started to realize that, was it just, were you angry about it? That you had these fans that were alien to you? Because I hear that from a lot of bands. That how did we attract these guys?
No, you can't be mad at people coming. Right. I mean, these are paying customers. These people came, they bought our record, they bought our tickets to come see us play. Like, I'm not mad at them. That's
right.
We made this music that, you know, if you're a ska band and a bunch of people that love ska music come to your concert, like, that makes sense.
Sure.
So if we make Fight the Right to Party and a lot of party bros put money down to see you play,
sure,
that makes sense.
Yeah. Right.
So I'm not mad at them.
Yeah,
it makes you question what you're doing. It's a reflection. It's a mirror. You know what I'm saying?
And
so, is that what we're doing here?
Yeah,
this is not what we should. No, I thought. Oh wait, this was a joke, you guys, and now it's not. It's
not a way of life.
No, it's not. It's not funny.
Yeah.
And there's a story in the book that's called "Become What You Hate," and we basically became these jokes that we made.
You had a persona, and now you were like, am I that guy or am I not that? You know,
but I was that guy, 100%.
Right. We created it, and it was really exciting when you do create it, and it's working, right?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, thousands of people are paying to see you be that. There's a point in that arc where it's really, really exciting. But then there's this thing of like, then you wake up, and it's your job, and it's also us coming being like these New York punk rock kids that love rap music. It was like, this is not what we didn't see it that far down, we didn't see the timeline that far.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, okay, we're gonna do this and then we're gonna become this, and then it was just, we're never good at making plans. It was just like, okay, this is funny to us, haha. Then we're doing that. Oh, whoa, this is actually working. This is exciting. And then it's like, wait, you mean we have to be these people? And not only be these people, play to this audience every
forever
night. How do we make this stop?
But also, if you're a comedian and you're just making racist jokes,
right?
If you're just making sexist jokes and you're like, no, it's ironic.
I'm
not that, but these jokes are.
Right.
Don't you get it?
Yeah. You're going to get a bunch of people that don't get it.
You are that. Uh-huh. If you make a bunch of sexist jokes and you stand behind them, then you are the sexist in the joke.
Yeah. So your reaction to that was Paul's Boutique.
But I think getting there, I don't think it's even reactions. Like that was like the next.
But right, but that was a way to elevate.
That was the next evolutionary step, because then with Paul's Boutique, it's like that was actually really the falling out with really more Russell and Rick. Like Rick had kind of bounce out, like he wanted to do something totally different and produce Slayer records and whatever. Russell was like the business person and wanted money. He's like, well, you guys gotta give me Fight Fair at the Party. You gotta go back into part two. You gotta
be
go
that
back
guy.
Into the
be those
you
guys you don't want to be.
And keep being and you're gonna get paid. So just go and do it. And we're like, I think he misjudged us thoroughly, because we came from this whole other by being like these weird punk rock kids. We were just like, as soon as he said that, it was like, fuck you.
Yeah.
We're not gonna just do this. And then
not gonna take it. No.
No.
I'm not gonna take it.
And with Paul's Boutique,
we're not gonna take it anymore.
You jumped record labels, you moved out here, right?
I wanna see if you could do that once.
It's a tough one, that thing.
I don't think I could do it even once.
Yeah.
You can.
We have one, there's one of these grippy muscle things. Oh my God.
It's a hard one.
Man, I gotta.
No, that's a hard one, though.
I have
it's
to
a
do
hard
an
one.
Exercise once.
It's a hard one. So.
Is it a stress reliever, though? What does it get done?
It's stressing me out.
That just sounded like something you would sample.
Right. But yes, Paul's Boutique was more a reaction of just everything that happened with Rick Rubin and Russell Simmons and the fallout and being sick of all of that, wanting to get out of New York. Friends around in New York, things were just getting fucking weird. So
it's that weird, that moment of like, wait, who is our friend? Who's not our friend? We can't really trust anybody in New York anymore.
Oh, really?
Russell had given like friends of ours jobs, and it's like, wait, we need to get as literally, you know, that's kind of like the amazing thing with LA. Like, you can go across the country, get as far as you can within this country from New York and be in this completely other world.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then start.
Meet the Dust Brothers.
Yeah. Also, you know, Hollywood is calling me, Mike. I mean, let's be real about what's going on.
That's true. Well, they really wanted your talent.
Yeah.
And you made a masterpiece.
That's what I say.
You mean Lost? Yeah. You mean
Lost Angels,
motion picture Lost Angels?
That's what
that
I'm talking
Adam
about. Yeah, you're great in that. Terrific. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a, I'd say, forgotten masterpiece. But
don't
I'm
you think,
trying to forget it, but it keeps coming up.
Don't you think Paul's Boutique sort of changed the game for everybody? I know I don't want you to be.
Yeah, but we didn't know.
At the time.
No.
Yeah, I mean, at the time it was a commercial flop.
How the fuck is that possible? I listened to it when it came out over and over again.
It doesn't have the hooks aren't there.
Let's just be honest.
The hooks aren't really there.
Yeah, there was no. I mean, I think like now we're able to.
But
talk
it's almost
about
like
it,
a psychedelic like, rap record. It's like fucking.
Yeah, but who's buying that?
Everybody wanted. They wanted to hear what was going to come next
after
for the
like,
Fight Fair Party
hits.
Dudes.
They wanted the hits. Yeah.
Right. They want so. And there's nothing. You look at it, it's pretty simple. Pretty basic. There's nothing on Paul's Boutique for that person.
I know, but you also had trouble with the label, right? They kind of buried it.
Yeah,
they decided to sort of focus on other esteemed artists like Donny Osmond.
That is fucking crazy. Out of all the people in the world, that you
big name in the game.
What? What year
he had
was that?
That one
was
song.
That?
And he had a TV show.
But yeah, but this
Donny
is
and Marie big.
No. He's got more than
Donny Osmond has probably played Las Vegas like 100 times more than maybe 300 times more than we ever have.
We've played Vegas 3 times.
Right. So I'm saying he's probably played 330 times. Wow. I would imagine.
That's a lot of times.
It's a big big name.
But
in the game.
What's okay, so they got one bad apple. Is that Donnie Solo? That's Donnie Solo. Or is that the Osmonds?
I think it's the Osmond Brothers.
Okay.
I can't name a single
I'm a little Osmond, bit country
but...
rock and roll.
Yeah, it wasn't really a song.
That's
Donnie and Marie. It was just like a TV shtick.
That's Donnie
like...
and Marie, though. No, name it was another a song. Yeah, it was a song.
Name another song.
I don't know.
Yeah.
They got nothing.
So after Paul's routine,
yeah, how did the Osmonds have such a big career off nothing?
Yeah. I feel confident in having a beef with Donny Osmond at this point.
Yeah, I think you're all right. I think
I'd like
right.
to move away from Cro-Mags and Migos.
Yeah, and get and, center
and
on
go
the,
towards open the door Donny. To Donny. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
After Paul's Boutique, you were disappointed, angry, what? Lethargic, despondent, despairing.
Kind of good. I don't know. We were actually kind of feeling good, really.
We were feeling good, but we were bummed out. I mean, when you go to the record company president dude's office and you're, you know, in the fancy office where the assistant shows you in and you're like, hey, we put all this work into making this record and we were excited about it because we thought like we loved De La Soul, we loved Public Enemy. We were like, okay, this is like our place in this. And we went for it. Like we sampled everything we could possibly think of and just layered sample after sample. Like we like, okay, this is going to be great. And then they're just like, oh, go make another record.
Right. You know, how long did it take you to do Paul? So like 2 years?
Probably.
Really, it was a year.
Well,
it was just that 1 year. It was 88.
It came out 89.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. So it was like a year and a half.
License Ill came out 86, but then we were on tour for a year and a half, so.
We started in like early 88, and it came out in 89. It was like a year.
Yeah, I guess a year. Why did it seem so much longer, though?
I don't know.
Is that about right?
I guess that's what happens when you're 19, 20 years old. Like a year seems like forever.
So much pot.
Yeah.
It was actually, even though that we did, we didn't tour, we didn't play any shows. Because that was a whole other thing that we got this new manager that was, he was Kenny Rogers' manager.
Yeah.
No, wait.
Yeah.
No.
Cher?
No. No. That would be really big. Yeah, but there was like
Prince?
Heart. No, it was that I wasn't even.
Dude.
You're giving like A-list names.
No,
it was
dude.
Like Heart and like the Eagles or something.
Those are pretty big.
I mean, sure, big names in the game.
Yeah. Eagles is pretty big.
Saying yeah. Don,
no, I'm
but,
telling
but
you.
By that point,
I'm
it was Don Henley. You. The Eagles hadn't reunited yet.
I'm telling you, there was some like fucking Kenny Rogers motherfucker. I'm telling you.
Michael Bolton, maybe?
Ooh.
Massive. At any rate, we played like a few shows and they were terrible at these like discos, but. We did have fun, my man Rich. It was so bad that it was funny.
It was really bad.
But then we're in like LA and we're like these New York dudes and like we're hanging out and you go to like The Source for breakfast.
Sure.
Hugo's and shit. Like we're hanging out, smoking pot.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
Driving a car.
Living in a house
kind of awesome.
But we also made every mistake. You know, but there are happy mistakes. Like we spent all this money on these fancy studios making the record and we like hired these fancy managers who didn't understand what we were doing at all. It was the worst thing we could have done.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's what happened.
That's LA.
Moved to LA.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's totally Hollywood.
Textbook LA. And then, you know, and then I guess, but then somehow we were lucky enough to realize like, wait, all right, so now, and that was also another part of sort of our freedom and being able to do what the fuck we wanted was that then we were basically, in terms of the record company, we had become a bag of dog shit. But, you know, they do not want to touch this bag of
but you still you stayed
no.
with them, right?
No, I don't want to.
No,
and I've had dogs too.
Right.
Yeah.
And so they don't. They want to keep it, but keep us at arm's distance. So like nobody wants to touch it. And
it's
and
like
they,
a
we have
Ziploc
this...
bag of dog shit.
Yeah, yeah. And so, but so then they're like, well, just go make another record. So it's like here. So here we are. We're going to make another record, and nobody from the record company wants to talk to us at all. So we have this wide open freedom. So we're like, all right, we started like actually practicing at Adam's house. Then his neighbors were not so excited about that.
Yeah.
And then we moved into a Hollywood rehearsal studio again. Very cliche. What happens in L.A. And then we're like
over
we should
on
get
Cole
our own
or somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
It was Cole.
Cole.
Yeah.
It was Cole. That place. Exactly.
Yeah, it's still
there.
Yeah.
And then we were like, all right, we need to get this. Kind of sucks to like go smoke pot, set up your stuff, and then second
pack
you kind of think you're doing something halfway decent, then you got to pack it back up. So then we're like, we got to find our own studio, and somehow through a friend, I'd never even been to Atwater. Like I was living in Silver Lake though, just over the bridge.
This is
time.
In the 80s, late 80s.
Yeah, and so then this or beginning of not yeah late 80s, beginning of 90s, and this friend's like, oh, there's this place. It's like an old ballroom or something. This studio in Atwater, you got to check it out. It's like really. Really sleepy there. There's nothing much happening. And we're like, okay, perfect.
And so, he built the studio. And that became, what was it called? G-Sun. Yeah.
So, but that really became our, like, we needed that. We needed to have, like, this headquarters, this place we could go every day and just listen to records, play music, have all our friends and just start.
It's a clubhouse and a studio.
It was a clubhouse.
And you had a skate ramp in there and a basketball court and everything.
You know what? I should have moved closer there.
Where were you?
You and Yauch should have.
We should have just moved to Atwood.
Why? Where were you?
If you'd bought houses then.
I know.
Like in Silver, you would be a.
Oh, I know.
You'd be like David Geffen right now.
Where were you living? Hollywood?
Maybe not like David Geffen, but you.
I was in Laurel Canyon. It was nice. I'm not saying it was. I'd love the house
that
I used
nice
to live
where
in.
You
I had
guys
a little
were in
pool
Laurel
and
Canyon,
all that shit.
Though.
But I'm just saying it's a drag. Like having to sober up and like drive home at 4 in the morning.
But that's where
every
like,
night.
It seemed like at that point, like there was a crew that sort of developed around that space, right? Like Spike Jones and Jason Lee and those cats and people started hanging around.
And Christian Hosoi. We had a lot of people coming in and out of that place.
I love
Like Q-Tip when, and it was also this thing because it was like this certain time in rap music too where everybody from New York would have to be in LA to like whatever, do soul, do some promotional
meetings and whatnot
thing meetings for sure meetings and then they'd come by this come by the studio and then we had this place where you could smoke pot and play basketball and make a mixtape or do whatever so it was it's interesting because it's not like we ever could have planned it we were not I'm still to this day are not good at planning but this thing evolved or took place where exactly it was this place where a lot of stuff could get made because it was where all these different people could hang out.
And you did three records there? You did Check Your Head and Ill Communication? And
Check Your Head, Ill Communication, and
some of Hell and Nasty there as well.
Yeah. And other things, right? We did other records
there.
Yeah,
we did
videos.
You
did
tons of videos. I did DFL there. We did tons of other things and produced other, I don't know what, the, did a whole, Mike started
Grand
the magazine
Royal,
there.
Grand Royal Magazine. Oh, yeah, Grand, was
and the label.
And the record
label.
And tons of bands would come in and play. And
you were actually producing stuff in that space for
I
other
think so,
bands?
Right?
Yeah.
And you
someone brought up the song that I did with MC Milk the other day. You don't even remember that.
Now you mention it, I remember, but I had completely forgotten about it.
I had completely forgotten about it, too.
And you did the clothing line for a while?
Yeah, X Large was kind of like that was a junk. Yeah,
you guys
that
are
was
like
in the neighborhood.
Full empire builders, entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
Yep.
But that's how I see it. Unfortunately, we didn't have the Maybachs to prove it or whatever you're supposed to have as an entrepreneur. Private jet.
What happened to that space? What's in that space now?
Adam was recently.
What?
They're doing things. They're just doing things.
It's still a space?
It's still a space. There's the actual, I'm sorry to whoever this is. I've forgotten your name, but he's the actual little small room where we did all the mixing of all of the songs. I had the tape decks where we did all the mixing. Someone actually still has that and uses it to mix records or songs or commercials or something. So that actual room is still in use as a musical
space. Well, actually, an interesting note, Diplo had the studio for a while, but then he became too big time. And
So it's still a studio. You guys built the studio.
Some of it is.
Yeah.
And the rest is like businesses. There's like weird.
Fun fact, Eli Bonners, who was my partner, one of my partners in X Large, he owns the building now or has for a while.
And like at some point, you guys decided to just play your instruments for real, and I thought that was I love those records where you guys just play and so like because you talk about in the book that there was this moment you had where you're like I'm a musician I can accept that
but
that
it took
was not
a while
that long ago
that but, no I know but it's
but
an
it
important
took a
moment
while.
Yeah
it, no it is I agree but it took a while like Check Your Head we weren't there we couldn't say that like we were really excited to play our instruments and we were excited to make music that was inspired by all these different records that we'd gotten to know from sampling and all this music that we love but
you just decided you could do it and it, like I listened to that this morning the later record where it's just,
The mix up
it's great.
Thank you.
It was great for you guys
Did you have fun doing that?
That one, yeah, that was fun.
Mix up was fun.
I had more fun making it than the record is, than I like the record.
Yeah. Well, I like how
there's
you're honest.
There's a couple moments on
There's
it,
a couple
though.
Moments I really like on
back
that.
And there's a couple little breaks, a couple little things where we would talk about how we'd want to make something to sound like this, and we usually wouldn't get there, and sometimes mix up a couple
nuggets,
couple bars.
Yeah, you guys got two songs on that record.
There's
I don't even know. Are there any songs?
I don't know, but there's some moments for sure.
No, it's nice to have on. You know,
it's nice to have on record.
It is. But I thought it was very funny. The amount of time you put into that, the Hot Sauce Committee Part 2 and making up these samples and sort of meticulously recapturing sounds to make a bunch of fake samples in order to sort of baffle and confuse record nerds. And the fact that you put all that effort into it, and as you wrote in the book, that it didn't really register to the people.
Nobody cared. But that's why I feel like good about that in the sense that just, yeah, that's our story, but it's also, it's probably your story as a comedian at some point. Any filmmaker's story.
Sure.
It's like, anybody who does anything creative, there's these things that you just go down the hole and just expend all this effort, and you're totally consumed by doing this thing, and you're like, oh, this is going to be the best thing ever, and nobody ever.
But I like that
cares.
It was almost like it was a comedy bit. It was you did it so perfectly that it got by. Like, you know, nobody picked up on it.
I think so.
Yeah,
that was the idea going in.
Yeah,
and for me, I like it because we'd been a band for so long, and at that point, then we'd actually kind of figured out how to play our instruments.
Yeah,
kind of figured out how to produce records.
Yeah.
Kind of figured out how to make these things that we never would have thought we could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
we could kind of knew what we were doing, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you're good or bad at it, it's just we kind of knew how to do it.
Yeah.
But, and that's the thing about the big ideas in pop songs. Like, nobody cares about a big idea in a pop song. That's why I love fucking Daft Punk, Around the World. It's just a dumb song that is awesome.
Yeah.
Nothing against Daft Punk.
Yeah.
How big are those guys? Are they big?
They were for a little while. Yeah.
No, I mean physically.
No. They're slight in build.
Okay.
Although Guimon from Daft Punk studies he was in a neck brace for a while from some martial art.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. So.
But you know what I'm saying? With popular music, like, you just want to fucking dance.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So you don't need the whole big idea.
Right.
The brainiacs need to get off the dance floor.
But in making
no, the brainiacs are usually pushed off the dance floor.
But
am I wrong with that?
Well,
no, you guys are kind of brainiacs.
But then Daft Punk are brainiacs that are on the dance floor.
You guys just clearly don't get what I'm saying.
I don't.
Because I'm not a brainiac. I'm just saying you just wanted, if like popular music, you just want to listen to the song.
Sure.
You just want to
move.
You just want to move. Move me. Don't fucking give me some, don't be clever at me.
Yeah, but you're an obsessive
guy,
right?
You're saying,
right?
Lakeside, Fantastic Voyage.
That's
you
what
don't
want to
overthink it. You just want to get on
it.
Just
around the
you
world.
You
around
hear
the
that,
world.
You just
they
get
don't
on the
see
floor.
Anything else than around the world.
Yeah. So, but you don't regret doing it.
No, I love it. That's what we do.
But like, it seemed like a real sort of obsessive kind of weird project that you just kind of kept going, right? You wanted those samples to sound perfect as if they were archival material.
You know, honestly, it was the thing of us, me personally, collecting records and obsessing over 45s and rare records and searching and sifting in any kind of pawn shop or thrift store anywhere to find like little rare records to sample and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Like, that time had already kind of passed.
Yeah.
So that obsession, I didn't really have that obsession anymore.
You don't?
Not anymore.
Do you have the records still?
Yeah, I still got all the records. But so that album, Hot Sauce Committee, was kind of like that obsession twisted in this weird sort of way.
Yeah.
And I really like it.
Yeah.
But my friend Dante Carfagna, big name in the record game, is mad at me because I don't have my records out. They're all in storage.
Right. Yeah,
how many
should.
You got?
I know, I'm getting them.
Get them. Because you may as well enjoy them.
I'm
going
to get them in
January,
which is something else I need to talk to you about, which we don't need.
You want
to
me
about.
To help you schlep all these records?
Yes, could you carry my records?
How many you got? Thousands?
Yeah, I got thousands of records.
Yeah.
You
but that's what
them?
You do when you're consumed with records.
I know, I love them. I've been getting records.
But these are just like records I got for a quarter, 50 cents, a dollar, you know what I mean?
Yeah, for the
like,
samples.
Mm-hmm.
But through that process, you became very like knowledgeable and open-minded and like it blew your brains out, right? Like by looking for samples, you learned about all these different kinds of music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's true.
I got
like, I don't
15
know.
Different copies of the Hair soundtrack. Different versions.
Well, there's so many different versions
so
of
many
Hair.
Versions.
I have
same
to
with,
go,
like, like, how many covers of Spinning Wheel do you have? Like, how many versions? I've got like 20. I mean,
of Spinning Wheel?
Put your hand in the hand. Has a breakbeat every cover version. It's 10 past 12.
I'm okay, we're going. What are you guys doing now outside of pushing the book? What are you working on?
I think we're going to work on lunch in the near future.
Yeah.
Right?
I'd love to work. Coffee and lunch would be, I'd love to have
you ever go to Cacao?
Future.
Cacao.
Yeah.
Cacao. Wait, no. Where's Cacao?
You live in Pasadena now, right?
I'm staying in Pasadena.
I'm sorry. Well, Cacao's like
yes, see, spoken. That's how New Yorkers. That's what New Yorkers say.
I'm staying in Pasadena
about LA.
For now.
It's on Colorado, next to the Trader Joe's in Eagle Rock. There's a little strip mall there, and there's a place called Cacao Mexicatessen. It's great. It's great.
Wow. Cacao.
If I come visit you, which I rarely do, will you order cacao?
You should check it out. You like Mexican food?
I won't.
Yeah, I'd rock. You like mustard, right?
I don't. Yeah. But I like tacos.
Yeah, they do some real good shit there.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, Mason's Dumplings, Eagle Rock.
Oh, that's good. I haven't been there yet.
You like soup dumplings?
I haven't really had them.
Really?
That's my new thing.
And he's obsessed with
soup. No, but I have a new thing, and it's do you like it? You hate it.
It bothers you. It irritates. Like, it's like I get stressed in like the root of my neck when you do it. It's like it's like I can't even control my mental reaction to it.
That's your new thing. All right, guys. That was great. I love the book. It was fun talking to you.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Good luck
with it. Tolerating us.
No, I enjoyed the book a lot and I like the music.
Well, there you go. Thank you.
Take care.
All right.
So that was it. That was what happened. It was as the Beastie Boys. It's a good book. The book is now available. So yeah, I would recommend that. And there's never a bad time to listen to Paul's Boutique or Check Your Head or Ill Communication. Those are my Beastie records. Again, my tour dates: Wheeler Opera House. Wheeler Opera House in Aspen and the Boulder Theater in Boulder are happening in March, correct? Yes. March 23rd, Wheeler Opera House. March 24th, the Boulder Theater. Tickets available for that at WTFpod.com/tour. You can get my latest special, Too Real, in audio format on the homepage of WTFpod.com. And now I will play 3 to 4 chords for you with a wah-wah pedal and an echo box. Boomer lives.